This is the Popmatic Podcast for June 1st.
Summertime. And the living is easy.
Pop-Pop-Matic.
This is the Popmatic Podcast. We're coming to you from Studio NPL in the heart of downtown Nashville. Joining me today are
Bill,
Amanda,
Mac, dude,
and I am Brian.
Welcome back.
The Popmatic Podcast is where you can rock out with your library card out, and we do not care what your school schedule says. We do not care what the calendar says. We don't care what astrologers say. Everyone knows that summer does not start until June 1st. Can I get a witness?
It starts like June 22nd.
I said I didn't care about that.
Shush, you and your solstice. I
said I, stupid position of the sun.
Yeah.
I specifically said that I did not care.
I care.
Is this part of your weather?
Yes.
Yeah. Actually, yeah.
It's a meteorological summer.
I don't care what the meteor. Okay, you get it. So on today's show, summertime. Now, we know that there's all kinds of amazing programs happening at the library in the summer, like Pride Fest, like the Puppet Festival, like, oh my lord, Summer Challenge!
Woo-woo.
And get pumped, because we are going to do episodes on all those things. This is going to be a magical summer. But today, summer kickoff, summertime, lemonade stands. Bill, it's really hot. Don't you like to go to the beach?
Of course I do. And in 1916, a rogue great white shark attacked swimmers along the Jersey shore, which in turn launched the most extensive shark hunt in history. This is a true story and was written about in a book called Close to Shore, The Terrifying Shark Attacks of 1916, written by Michael Capuzzo. We have this title in our collection. Now, this particular incident also inspired another writer to write his own novel, but this time a work of fiction. The writer was Peter Benchley, and the name of the book was called Jaws.
Da-dum.
Yeah.
We have this novel in our collection, and it's about a great white shark that attacks a small resort town. Jaws was a critically mixed novel, but as a hardcover, it spent 44 weeks on the bestseller list. And when it went to paperback, it sold millions. Of course, Hollywood bought the novel to make it into a movie. Now, here's an interesting sidebar, personal. I read the book way before the movie came out, and my teenage mind wondered how they were going to make this movie. The book was full of foul language and was extremely violent. At the time, I did not understand the art of adaptation. Now, on to the summer of June 1975. Jaws was released.
There is a creature alive today who has survived millions of years of evolution without change, without passion, and without logic. It lives to kill. A mindless eating machine. It will attack and devour anything. It is as if God created the devil and gave him jaws.
And let me take that back. It really wasn't released. It exploded across America. I was 14 years old, and I can still remember the summer of 1975 when the movie came out. There were lines around the block. The movie made the cover of Time magazine, and it became the number one moneymaker of all time for a while, and put Steven Spielberg on the map. Now, the thing about it, let me emphasize, this was 1975. You had to go see it at the theater. This was before Blockbuster. This was before streaming services like Netflix. The only time you were not going to see Jaws was when it was sold to television, cut up with television commercial. Mm. There wasn't HBO. It was a different time, folks. So literally, people were going, and I went on a weeknight, like this Wednesday night, and the theater was packed. So you had to go see it at the theater. And it also introduced the summer blockbuster. Oh, I wanted to mention one fact about the movie. The writer Peter Benchley is in the movie.
What?
He's the newscaster that talks to the camera. So he's in it. Now, to become a blockbuster, that was the downside to Jaws. It introduced the summer blockbuster. If you want to learn more about this, please watch a documentary we have in our collection called A Decade Under the Influence. It will talk about this phenomenon called Jaws. However, Jaws the movie, I love. It's got horror, suspense, high adventure all rolled into one. I showed Jaws a few years back at our movies at Maine, and it was so much fun to sit there and watch it with an audience. A lot of kids were there. And they were great, respectful, and I knew they had never seen it because they were jumping at all the right moments. And Jaws is a movie that's really made for a crowd. It's a lot more fun to see it in a theater with a crowd. And make sure you ask Crystal Dean, who works in our popular materials department, about Jaws. She loves it. And so, one more thing about Jaws. There's a book in our collection called The Jaws Log by Carl Gotland. Carl Gotland was the co-writer of the screenplay to Jaws and wrote a production diary of the making of the movie. This book has also influenced Steven Soderbergh and Eli Roth filmmakers. Also in our collection, we have John Williams' brilliant score. Let's see. I'm done. Amanda?
I've never seen Jaws, and I think if I ever... I've seen parts of it, but if I ever watched it all the way through, I would never go swimming again.
Yeah. Well, so I just kind of have it. Didn't go to the beach. That was bad for tourism that year. It had such an effect. It had touched on two things. Not only the fear of shark, but the fear of the water.
Yeah, you don't know what's down there.
It's a big, gigantic... So it had a major effect.
I'm not. Okay. Did you want to say something?
I was going to say, as a movie nerd confession, I've only seen most of it. But I've seen Deep Blue Sea. That's good.
I've seen parts of that one, too. Kind of had the same. That one's not as creepy as Jaws.
That one's hilarious.
Is that LL Cool J in that?
Yeah. He says his hat's like a shark's fin.
Uh-huh.
And he's got a parrot.
Okay. For some reason, each year, pop artists battle en masse to release what will be known as that year's song of the summer. So in 1966, it was Lovin' Spoonful's Summer in the City.
Yes, I was actually thinking to talk about that at one point. Oh, boy.
Hot town, summer in the city, back of my neck getting dirty and gritty.
How about Bananarama?
No.
They were, oh, you don't like Cruel Summer? 1983?
All I know is the Venus and the Desire.
Oh, no. Bananarama. Classic. So last summer was Maroon 5's Oddly Vulgar, The Summer's Gonna Hurt Like a Mother. All of these are great, with maybe an exception for the last one. But let's not forget this guy.
Drums, please!
A groove slightly transformed, just a bit of a break from the norm, just a little something to break the monotony.
So lots of fun summer songs, but today I'm going to kick it way old school. In 1935, the King of Tin Pan Alley, George Gershwin, premiered his opera Porgy and Bess. The first major aria in the opera is called Summertime, and over time it has worked its way into the standard jazz canon. Summertime is one of my favorite jazz standards to play because there's lots of great crunchy dissonance. So let's take a listen to the slow jam. Version was sung by Barry Manilow, Diane Shore, and it featured Stan Getz on the saxophone. I really like Stan Getz. He's a good saxophone player. Porgy and Bess is set during a sweltering summer on Catfish Row in the slums of Jazz Age Charleston. The libretto is based on DuBose Hayward's 1925 novel entitled simply Porgy. Hayward joins Gershwin's brother Ira in writing the libretto for the work. In the story, Porgy is a poor crippled beggar who takes up with Bess after her boyfriend kills another man in the slums and runs away. The only non-singing parts for the cast are for the white policemen who come by the row every now and again to kind of stir things up. But like any good story set on the coast in the summer, there's a hurricane scene in the middle of the opera.
I was wondering why you like this.
Which, of course, totally rocks my world. Uh-huh. And then the events during and following the hurricane set up the back end of the story, which I'm not going to spoil for you. Porgy and Bess was not the first opera that called for an all-black cast, but it was the first to achieve what could be argued as monumental success. They ended up going on a European tour after World War II to great acclaim. The library has just about any incarnation you want. We have Hayward's novel, which I did read, and it was good. We have a complete recording on CD of the whole opera, which is fun because it has Cab Calloway as one of the supporting characters. You can check out the DVD and watch the opera if you want visuals to go with the music. And there are also several versions of the song Summertime, downloadable from Freegal, from the Barry Manilow that I played earlier, to Miles Davis, to a kind of interesting version done by Janis Joplin. You can even download the Fresh Prince from Freegal if Gershwin's not your thing. So happy summertime, everybody, and let's get it on. Summer challenge.
Whatever happened to DJ Jazzy Jeff?
He's probably very rich.
Living in the French person's like garage.
Yeah, there you go. He ran out of Cheetos. So this week, surfing. Beaches, boards, and babes. Yeah, as you probably guess, I'm not exactly king of the surfers. My only surfing experience was falling off a boogie board repeatedly near the beaches of Gloucester, Massachusetts in the summer of 1991. Good times. However, I'm a big fan of surf rock music. Not only does the distinctive guitar twang get my feet a dancing, but I also don't have to get salt water up my nose, have my no good cousins mock my surfing ineptitude, and experience the harsh rays of the sun. Win, win, win. Longtime listeners may remember when I recommended La Luz and the Stevie Ray Vaughan / Dick Dale cover of The Ventures Pipeline last year for Tickle My Fancy. Today I thought I would promote only one of them to the main segment. That's right. Where one rises, the others fall. This week, Dick Dale, King of the Surf Guitar. Dick Dale was born Richard Anthony Monsoor in Boston on May 4th, 1937. Eventually, his family would relocate to Southern California in the 1950s, and young Dale would become involved with the burgeoning surf scene there. Interestingly enough, he credits his Lebanese heritage with the development of surf rock. He learned to play a tarabaki, which is a kind of drum, and he watched his uncle play this like weird-looking lute called an oud. It looks really neat. My source goes into incredible detail about his style of playing the guitar and how it came about, but I'm not a music nerd, so the bit that interested me was the bit about he would play so loudly that he would continuously blow up his amps. Eventually, he wrote to Lou Fender himself, he of the Stratocaster, and requested a custom-made amp. So while normal amps maxed out at 4, his maxed out at 10. Yeah. Which is why some credit with him with being the father of heavy metal. I don't know who those people are, but they're awesome. Today, I'd like to highlight two songs. His most popular song, and the song that was featured on the Pulp Fiction soundtrack and that revitalized his career in the mid-90s, and most importantly got him on my radar, was Miserloo. Fun fact, it's cover of an old folk song from somewhere in the Eastern Mediterranean, possibly. I found sources that say it's from Egypt, Turkey, Greece, and Lebanon.
It's like, Atlantis?
Yes.
Atlantis? It could be from Atlantis, right?
It could be. Okay. There was a tiny island in the Aegean. Records of it exist as early as 1919. But we have the surf version on Guitar Legend, The Very Best of Dick Dale, which is on Hoopla, or we have the Pulp Fiction soundtrack. If you want to hear 30 seconds of Tim Roth saying Honey Bunny every time you rewind the song, which I did, then you watch Pulp Fiction 20 years later, and like you barely remember it, but you remember one scene really well because you rewound Miserloo a lot. Anyway, that's just me. In 1994, he would release the album Unknown Territory, which is top to bottom amazing. Looking over the track listing, you may be like, even the second cover he made of Hava Nigila is amazing? And I would be like, hills yes! The second cover of Hava Nigila is even better. But I'm here to recommend not Hava Nigila, which you usually listen to on your own time, but... Look, I am. But the first track, Scalped. My dad played Unknown Territory a lot when I was a teen, and I may have borrowed it for a long time. In fact, I may be still borrowing it to this day. But one of my favorite movie memories is watching Escape from L.A. in the theater in, I believe, 1996 with him, and us both freaking out when they start playing Scalped when Snake Plissken starts surfing the L.A. Reservoir. It was awesome. Unknown Territory is on Hoopla. Dick Dale still tours. In my future, but your past listeners, I hope to be seeing him live at something called the Nashville Palace on this Friday, your last Friday. Woo-hoo. He apparently uses the money to pay for medical treatments, which is such a bummer. So I'll leave you with that.
Yeah. Way to bring us down. Yes, me being the king of all bummers was going to point out that Dick Dale's very open about the fact that he sort of wishes he could tour less, but has to pay his medical bills, which maybe that's America in a nutshell. All right. I never understood why people read more in the summer. The weather is beautiful. Go to the beach. Go to a concert. Go to an opera.
It's hot outside.
I read outside.
I don't read outside. I read the air conditioning, the fan.
That's what I do. People are weird.
The weather is nice. Go do something. The wintertime, it's cold. It's miserable. Yes. Burn something. Yeah. Make a cup of tea.
Not a book. Don't burn a book.
Depends what book it is.
Yeah. It's Huckleberry Finn. I'll hand you a copy.
The electric bills are out of sight.
Yeah. Ugh.
You know, sweater, snuggy. Book, perfect. Wintertime's the time to read. But I know that I'm in the minority about this. And I know that people like something called quote-unquote Beach Reads, Popmatic Podcast. Why am I even doing this? Hard left turn!
This is a Jeremy-esque tangent. He's not even here.
So if the beach read is when you're like, I'm just going to relax. I'm just going to read, you know, whatever I want. What do I want to read? You know, what's going to tickle my fancy the most? And for me, that book would definitely be Federal Trade Commission, Privacy Law and Policy by Chris Hufnagel.
That was second on my list.
You know, I was expecting a hard left turn. I didn't know it'd be so left to be going right again.
It's like NASCAR.
Yeah.
So this book is very new, and it was just recently cataloged by Mike.
Oh, hi.
I hope you did it right.
I do too.
Mike did a really good job cataloging it.
Great.
So Federal Trade Commission privacy law and policy is basically a history of the FTC, which most people don't know about. And it's really fascinating to see like what FTC actually does or doesn't do, especially compared to the FCC. Now, I am particularly interested in privacy law. Remember, you can choose privacy all year.
Well, I would, but I can't. I won't tell you.
And so the idea of like how this department came about, and it's interesting too, just because you hear the name, everyone knows the name, but I don't think anyone actually knows what the agency actually does. Or I guess it's not an agency, it's a commission. What it has done over the years and how it changes depending on who's in political power, or not even who's in political power, but just like the social norms of the day. And now they are one of the primary government agencies tasked with protecting consumer privacy. So that's how we get to privacy, but it takes a long time to get there. But this big buildup, basically you will learn a bunch of history that you never knew before. And Hufnagel is a law scholar, and he was willing to go back and dig through a bunch of really boring government archives and do his best to make it not so boring. Weird other little note, Hufnagel is also a footnote in the history of denialism, which is in philosophy, that's the phenomenon where people know facts that are true, but just deny them. But that's before he became a privacy scholar.
Like Cleopatra is the queen of denial.
You need Jeremy for that one.
I miss him sometimes.
He'd have had 14 more after it.
Yeah. We would have had riffs and stuff. Mm-hmm. It'd been fun.
So if you want to bury your head in the sand while on the beach and put yourself into a deep, restful sleep, I recommend Federal Trade Commission Privacy Law and Policy by Chris Hufnagel.
Is it a big book? Like, is it like a tome? Is it huge
It is not a tome.
Okay.
I feel a lot better for recommending Insomnia a couple weeks ago.
Because that's, I mean, I don't want to have a heavy book on the beach. I want a small book.
You could use it to whack away children who are obscuring your son.
It is 300 pages.
Oh, that's nothing.
And
a blistering trade action.
Yeah, I'm sure it just flies right by.
Yeah, it's a roller coaster.
There are many, 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 many footnotes. Well. The chapters about accuracy in wool labeling are fascinating. Hey, guys.
Hey, Brian.
Hey, Brian.
What do we do during Tickle My Fancy?
Well,
maybe the library has it. Maybe the library doesn't. But either way, it's tickling our fancy. Bill?
Tickling My Fancy is Gilbert Gottfried's amazing, colossal podcast. Now, before you throw up in your mouth.
Oh, too late.
Yeah.
I think I threw up in my ears.
Yeah, he could have retired after being Iago, and I would not mind.
Yeah, he wins for that.
That was a highlight.
If you're interested in pop culture, like I am, like 70s movies, obscure television shows and television movies, and the strange sexual perversion of Cesar Romero, who played the Joker on Batman, this podcast is for you. Now, the podcast is co-hosted by Frank Santopadre, who balances Gilbert Gottfried's somewhat eccentricities. And Gilbert Gottfried does have that heckling laugh, but it kind of grows on you after a while. They do a really good job with interviews. They've interviewed Joe Dante, Peter Marshall, Dick Van Dyke. I'm listening to a really interesting one with Bruce Dern right now. And when they don't talk about do interviews, they talk about things that, you know, that they're interested in, like they brought up the movie Night Moves.
Cool.
You know, Gene Hackman films, and they love the movie Night Moves.
They should.
So it's good talk, and it's a lot of fun. I highly recommend it. And one more thing, if you listen to Mark Hudson interview, you'll find out what happened to Rod Hulls and his emu. Enough said. Amanda.
I think I'm going to skip that
one. Yeah, it'd be tough to emulate.
Do you stay up at night thinking of these? Wow, if anyone says emu, I'm going to say emulate.
I had to go through my mental databanks to figure out anything that emu in it.
We need to make note cards.
Well, just say I would totally do that.
I'll Pun send card. You a link to Rod since we're
in
his emu.
Let's see. If I was working the week that I, my birthday, I would request you do a pun episode, and then only I would show up. But I wouldn't care.
You show up for that. Hide under the table. Okay. It seems like after a decade, sometimes longer series tend to get a little stale. Charlene Harris went through it with the Suki Stackhouse series, which probably should have ended about four books before it actually did. Laurel K. Hamilton went through a huge change of direction, complete with a fan rift for her Anita Blake series. And while I seriously considered breaking up with both of these, I'm glad I didn't, because Anita Blake at least came back from the dead, literally, and returned to the more popular, less orgiastic plot lines. Suki thankfully ended, sort of, and I think if she hadn't, I would have ended it anyway. And I haven't read the continuing short stories that Harris keeps putting out to get more money. Another series that I've been flirting with leaving would definitely be the Black Dagger Brotherhood. I've mentioned it before on the podcast. At first, I liked it, but then, like Anita Blake, author J.R. Ward spun her tale into more sex and drugs, with her characters sounding like mentally deranged drug dealers all the time.
Yeah! I'm interested. It's like I'll speed on along.
So it's hard for me. It's really hard for me to stop reading a series once I start. So I hung on to this one, even though reading parts of it were like scratching my nails down a chalkboard. And I was just kind of going through the motions just to kind of see, if it ever did get better. And luckily, the latest release did. Ward revisited one of her original couples in The Beast, and it was more about family and rebuilding lives instead of sex all the time. And I was surprised at how much I liked it and how sad I was when it was over. I kept kind of wanting to go back and read it some more. And I hope that's a good sign for future installments of this decade-old series. I'd also like to mention that Ward has spun off a related series called The Black Dagger Legacy that is about the next generation. The first one in that series is called Blood Kiss. The library has it. Paperback form. It was good. So these are both real strong reboots to a tired, waning storyline. And here's hoping that Ward stays on track with these.
I just want to throw out there that we have a video of J.R. Ward's appearance.
Yeah, because she was here when she has it. It was for the other series that she.
Yeah, it wasn't for the Black Dagger Brotherhood. It was for
the Bourbon King series the new one that's supposed to come out this summer sometime, I think, but I haven't seen a release date yet.
And I want to ask about, there was a fan rift with the Anita Blake series. Uh-huh. Can you elaborate?
We could totally go into detail if you like.
Can you elaborate without spoilage?
So about the first six or seven books of the story are very much, Anita Blake she raises zombies from the dead. I think they call her a reanimator. I can't remember exactly. And then she hunts vampires. So the first several books in the series are very much about her as a reanimator and with all the zombiness and like hunting vampires. And then this happened when Laurel K. Hamilton was married to her first husband, then she got divorced. And so then, like, when she met her second husband and was going through all of this, then it became, like, this whole, like, she started marrying, like, 85 vampires, and there's, like, this whole, like, polyamorous, she sleeps with basically everybody because she has this disease that she has to have sex or, like, the world explodes, and...
Wow.
Yeah, like,
I hope I don't get that disease.
Me
took
either.
A hard left turn. and so, like, the fans got divided between the ones that wanted, like, Anita Blake, the vampire hunter, versus Anita Blake, the sex whore. So, and then, I think there's, like, I don't remember how many, there's, like, 20 books in the series.
There's a bunch.
So after about 15 or 16, and Hamilton finally listened and kind of went back, like, now she's got a better balance of vampire hunter,
only
sex whore.
Sometimes orgy. Occasionally.
Yeah, I mean, well, it seems to be each book is kind of focused more on Anita's relationship with one of her guys as opposed to 15 of her guys.
See, we got they adapted to a comic book series.
Yeah, there's graphic novels.
I believe Marvel may have, or maybe one of their offshoots.
Yeah, I haven't read the graphic novels because I feel like I've already read the story.
I've flipped through it for professional reasons, and I don't remember there being sex orgies, so I think it's only based on the first couple.
Probably, and I will say that I think part of the reason I haven't looked at it is because I don't like the graphic representation. Thank you. Yeah. I don't like how she looks, and I don't like how Jean-Claude. It doesn't look like what I think they look like, so mm-hmm. It kind of is distracting. So I'm just like, I'm good. I'll just read the books.
You know, once again, I think I've brought this up before. You won't watch Jaws, but you read these books about reanimating corpses and have sex.
But I'm not going to go into a cemetery and reanimate corpses. I'm going to go swimming.
I think that she, like, mentally doesn't go into, like, as much detail as perhaps the author does, you know, maybe.
For what?
You maybe not be going as much detail as the author does on, like, you know, horrifying monsters, and maybe you skip over that part.
No, I don't skip over anything, but I think because I have control over it in my brain, like, that.
It's much more PG?
Yes. Okay. I edit it subconsciously.
Jeepers. Oh, right. Oh, and you know that they adapted Harry Dresden into comic books as well.
Yeah, and his actually have different storylines. Yes. I've read some of them and I haven't read some of them.
Yeah, it's pretty neat.
Yeah, I love Harry Dresden. New book of his coming out this summer, too.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Man, I'm so far behind. Anywho, one thing that I love is mashing up something dark and scary with something happy and cute. I have multiple plush Cthulhus, even one dressed up as an adorable little private eye with a little briefcase. Oh. In a similar vein, as recently...
Wait, so we got to... Can you tell what Cthulhu is?
Yeah, I don't know what a Cthulhu is.
Oh, gang. Well, in the H.P. Lovecraft mythos, Cthulhu is a tentacle-faced, octopus-like, with wings, god that presages the fall of mankind and the death of the universe or something like that. He sleeps in dreaded Wilaya. And, you know, there's a lot of, like, you know, cultists try to wake him up and, like, harvest, you know, destroy the world.
Cool.
So at your house, there's Moonlights as a private eye in his free time when he's not destroying the world.
There's some at Dragon Con. They had like these guys have like little like adorable like they're stuffed and like you know he's got kind of like a mean expression, but he's like this. You know, he's like a couple inches, like 6 inches tall maybe, and he's got like
I crush you.
He's got a little like you know bright green fur.
I know those guys. When you pay them, if you got correct change, they'll yell out correct change.
Yes, those guys.
Yeah, I know those guys.
Yeah, I think it's Steve Jackson Games maybe.
Yeah.
I always forget to bring correct change because I love it when they yell at you. Anyway, in a similar vein, I was recently perusing YouTube, you know, as is my wont, and I discovered the existence of True Cult Surf Music, which is spelled with all the U's as V's, because it's basically a mashup of the happy, fun surf rock that I love with dark and depressing black metal. And the description of each track, there's a weird alternate history of surfing corpse-painted death Swedes in California in the early 1960s. A very sad face that they're available to buy, but there are a bunch on YouTube if you spell it with V's instead of U's. Might I recommend The Dark Thrones' Californian Hunger?
That kind of sounds awesome.
It is amazing. And then they'll have like, you know, since YouTube will have like videos of like this guy with, you know, dull, you know, frowny face with like the corpse paint and all that on a surfboard and like black and white. Yeah. It's amazing. So do you have something, Brian?
I might have two things since Jeremy isn't here to hog all the mic time. So undeniably, what is tickling my fancy is Maria Bamford's show on Netflix, Lady Dynamite.
It's time for me to be less cautious. You think I'm ready to date?
Good, because I've already set you up with someone I know. He's bisexual. He also has a crippling meth addiction.
Sounds good. I was on top of the world. I had it all.
Maria, we're going to talk movies, TV, music, fashion. Welcome to the big leagues, baby girl.
Overwhelmed. I can't do it. I am so filled with energy.
Maria, have you ever been diagnosed with any mental illness?
You say diagnosis, I say diagnosis. I'm just trying to get some balance in my life. The only two friends I have left are Dagmar and Larissa.
You didn't even visit Maria in her time in need.
I'm sure you were very busy, Larissa.
I wasn't. Okay. I wasn't busy at all.
Thank you for coming to the Bamford family meeting!
Don't do that. I'm having bladder trouble.
That's it.
The floodgates have opened. Okay.
Maybe this is a part of my road to wellness, to reconnect, to try again.
I needed to learn how to take care of myself. I used to think more was more, but now I realize less.
Sorry, I trained my body to sleep with my eyes open.
We're back. Clank, clank.
You're gonna walk right into this fist. And this one! I'm not in the right place, am I?
You just read for a 22-year-old black male and nailed it.
Thank you so much.
And I don't wanna belabor the Bamfu point. What is perhaps best about it is that it's not funny at all, but it is brilliant and brain-twisting in a very good way. It's almost as if Tim and Eric or Mr. Show knew how to make a show. You get some really brilliant satire, but also with the storyline, with healthy dose of bizarro world surrealism thrown in. It's unlike anything I think I've really seen before on TV, but it's not on TV. It's on the internet. I even like the credits, you know, I'm, you guys know how completely shallow I am. I judge books by the cover. I judge shows and movies by the credits. Scorpius all the way. So that's the callback to a joke that I like it, even
that
make
we're
it
gonna do later.
Okay.
Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
He so evilly spoils his own jokes.
Spoiler alert. Callback to a joke that nobody would even get because we didn't even put it in context, that it's about Farscape, which is like this
amazing science fiction show.
Outtake from 3 weeks ago. Stumbling along. So instead of talking about something that we've talked about before that you can't even get from the library right now, why don't I talk about something you can get from the library but has very little popular appeal, maybe even less so than a book about the FTC. That, of course, would be the new Youth Code album, Commitment to Complications. You guys remember Youth Code for being the industrial EBM duo that sort of revitalized the industrial scene last year with their self-titled record. Well, finally, their sophomore effort has been released, Commitment to Complications. It's great. It's more the same. There's one thing that's a little different is that lead vocalist Sarah Taylor, they didn't really distort her vocals that much. They just like recorded them as raw as possible. And she's pretty much your typical like hardcore punk singer. So I don't know if this change is good or bad. Like, I think if you're doing the sort of like retro kind of really strict beats per minute and someone screaming over it, I think one of the ways that you kind of create textures and difference is by how you treat the vocals electronically. But I'm still wondering how she has a throat left, though. I don't know how people who sing that way or scream that way tour ever. But her voice is pretty much like sandpaper on the inside of your skull. And if you're into that, go for it. They were just recently in Nashville. They opened for Baroness, which was an interesting...
Wow, that's...
Yeah, really interesting mix. But if you want to follow Youth Code on Twitter, they have some really great pictures up where Sarah has burnt her hand very badly on a hotel coffee pot. Looks like maybe a second-degree burn, but they're on tour, so live with that scar.
Wrap it up and go on.
And the show must go on.
Corrections!
I don't have any corrections.
Actually, I do have one. Old Jeremy did not apparently read the possible article, or an article I saw recently that Marvel's Defenders movie is going to have a phase two. They're going to premiere new shows, and they're thinking of premiering one based on His Holy Moon Knight and Ghost Rider.
I thought I had heard something about Moon Knight. Yeah. I wasn't sure if that was just a delusion or not. So I don't have any corrections, but I have some addendums. The version of Moonlight Sonata at the end was performed by Dr. Viasi, who is a guy that does shred metal.
It was pretty cool.
It was amazing.
I was like, he found one!
It was the highlight of the episode for me, you guys.
It was high quality, Adam.
I was in love.
He does shred metal versions of classical pieces. That clip has been viewed over 8 million times.
8 million and one right here.
That's right.
The Summertime lyric sung at the end was by Sam Cooke from Porgy and Bess, which Amanda talked about earlier. And the clips of Moonlight Sonata that were actually in the show were from this very generic, crappy Beethoven comp.
Which you can download on Freegal.
It's called Sonatas para Beethoven. It's on Freegal. But the one that I actually linked to were the complete sonatas performed by Arthur Brendel on CD, if you want to get it from the library. The reason I didn't link to the one on Freegal was there's no other information about who's playing or where it was recorded or anything. And maybe this is just insider game, but for all of you patrons or library employees that want all that stuff in Freegal in the catalog, maybe you should think twice, because there are a lot of records like that that would be junking up our catalog if Freegal got automatically batch loaded up into our catalog. And since Mike is here again, I just going to say that if I'm anyone from Farscape, I am Scorpius. All right. Okay. So
I did think about that afterwards, because Christ becomes good at some point and Brian is never good.
So for more information about classical music recording, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org.
And our theme music is by
Adam Dean.
You can subscribe to the Popmatic Podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, and RSS. That way you never miss an episode, like the episode we're going to record next week about
Stephen King.
Oh, yes. It'll be quite a creep show.
I got outvoted.
Wink, wink, nudge. Yeah.
Superstition, prayers doused in black and set ablaze. A piss gold sky opened up for the storm, a birthing of a union of malaise. In gutters lined in spit, I lay and wait, gnawing at the thrill of finding home. Entrapment of a passion led by fate, a scorched and lustlorn path forever roamed. This sickness, ageless torment.